Hello, all. Welcome to the God Said of Us podcast. This is Patrick Barney. I'm one of the editors of Kai Draconis Books. With me today are the two other editors of Kai Draconis Books, Hans Berger and Chris Malmberg. As usual, if you want to get one of our books for free, just go to our website, xidraconis.org. We are an anarchist indie press interested in publishing socially engaged literature. So if you're a lefty and you're interested in reading a book about how Trump sucks or about how maybe we should treat sex offenders like humans, I don't know about that one. But
there's been some debate about that one.
There's some debate. So if you're a lefty, you should go to our website, the website I've just said. Pick out one of our books, send me an email, and I'll send you a free copy. Today, as a kind of companion piece to our last podcast, which was on Jane Austen, Sense and Sensibility, we are going to be talking about John Knowles, the Fowls. French Lieutenant. Knowles, is that how you
Fowls.
Say it?
Fowls. Like
Fowls?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought like it was Patrick, Knowles.
Like Patrick Fowls, the introduction to the book.
Okay, my bad. John Fowles, the author of John Fowles is the French Lieutenant's Woman. Question before I hand it over to you, Hans. This
sure.
is your pick.
Yeah.
Do we have to call it the French Lieutenant's Woman? Since Fowles is an English author and all English people are going to say it as the Lieutenant's Woman, the French Lieutenant's Woman.
I would say no, personally. I mean, it seems like maybe an unnecessary pretension to do so.
Okay,
it's somewhat in the realm of I teach online classes on writing about literature for the University of Alaska, and once in a while I will. Have a particular once in a while I'll have a student who regards themselves as particularly bright and engaged, and the way that they will prove that is by using the British spelling of common words. And
sure.
I do not regard that affectation as charming. So,
okay.
I think being uncultured Yanks, we can go ahead and say lieutenant. That'd be just fine with me.
Okay, the French Lieutenant's Woman. Where do you want to start, Hans? I have some ideas, some things that I think I want to get said, but it was your pick, so I think we should start with where you want to talk about.
Sure. Well, the thing that, I mean, the reason that we're talking about this book is it's the last episode of the podcast we did, Sense and Sensibility, and... when I read Sense and Sensibility, I had just read this book for the first time a couple months before that, and I just found them interesting in relationship to each other in terms of, well, I mean, the way that I found, the first time that I read French Lieutenant's Woman, the thing that struck me the most about it was the way that it portrays upper-class English society, and I may have used some version of this thought in the Sense and Sensibility podcast, so I'm sorry if I'm repeating myself a bit. But on first reading of French Lieutenant's Woman, what struck me about it was that it portrays upper-class English society as sort of a kind of a totalitarian system, right? And not necessarily a more of like a social and economic totalitarian system, but one in which small behaviors are scrutinized and carry great consequence and weight. Very small decisions are scrutinized and carry great consequence and weight in a way that's almost a bit 1984-ish, even though, you know, that restriction is coming from the relationship of social class and economic opportunity rather than and social reputation rather than for the most part from the force of government, right? And reading Sense and Sensibility with that as you know, when we talked about Sense and Sensibility last week, reading that novel with kind of the residual taste of French Lieutenant's Woman made the... I feel like I was much more aware in reading Sense and Sensibility of how very kind of curtailed and prescribed very small personal decisions were for those characters. I was aware of that in a way that maybe I would less... It wouldn't have been so much a focus if I hadn't been reading this. So I thought it would be interesting to, for myself to reread it shortly after Sense and Sensibility, and just again to kind of talk about it on the podcast as sort of a companion piece. I think that the, and we can talk about that a bit. I'm reading it a second time before the podcast. There's a different relationship that it had to Sense and Sensibility that I might also be interested in talking about, a different kind of distinction. But maybe, do we want to start with talking about how the I don't know if you guys have any thoughts about how the kind of maybe the ideas of restriction versus liberty in this book and in Sense and Sensibility, how those play off each other?
Yeah, I'd be curious to ask if you how you felt they were different, because going back to our Sense and Sensibility discussion, I remember making the observation, perhaps incorrectly, but my observation was that it seemed as though the propriety, the rules of society mm-hmm. actually could be, while they were restrictions, they also provided armature. They provided like surfaces off of which different people with roles that might be subservient or in power could play mm-hmm. off of. They could use those rules. They could navigate in that space using those rules. Right. And in some way, like, there was a value derived from their existence. And I felt actually, you know, reading through the French Lieutenant's Woman that while that was still the case, I don't know if it was still the case. I was wondering, like, did you see the restrictions painted in a more negative light in the French Lieutenant's Woman? Is it too simple to abstract? Abstract the treatment in that way, or?
Well, I think that the French Lieutenant's Woman, of course, for listeners who might not be familiar with it or haven't read it in a while, it was written in, I believe it was first published in 1969. Probably took a few years to write prior to that. So it was written in 1969, but as far as the particular matter of restriction goes, it, you know, Sense and Sensibility, the ways that the characters are restricted in small decisions, like whether or not they write a letter to somebody that they're not married, that they're not engaged to, those are taken so much for granted that they're not called out, right? And if you aren't reading the text closely, or as I did with a well-annotated version, it can be easy to miss the social significance of small decisions or the kind of restriction that is put on small decisions. Whereas the French Lieutenant's Woman is very explicitly, even though it's set in 1867, it's very, very explicitly narrated by someone who is taking the vantage point of a modern observer, right? And it's meant to be, in some ways, a tour of the Victorian era as narrated by someone who, you know, whereas in the Austen book, the narrator shares the consciousness of the characters, shares the awareness of the characters. In The French Lieutenant's Woman, the narrator very explicitly has the consciousness of a person from the late 60s, right? And so, you know, there are certain ways in which where Sense and Sensibility takes small restrictions for granted, French Lieutenant's Woman explicitly calls attention to some of what might seem like the strangeness or the arbitrariness. One instance that comes to mind is the title character, Sarah Woodruff, known as the French Lieutenant's Woman, politely, is that she, so the title character Sarah Woodruff has had a an affair with a French lieutenant, which has led to her sort of semi-expulsion from polite society, ending with her being a charity case for a woman named Mrs. Pulteney, who's very, very, very strict. And
The narrator explicitly compares her to, like, Nazis in the SS.
Right, right.
Mrs. Pulteney.
And so, you know, Sarah is living in Mrs. Pulteney's house because, you know, she, to some extent, because economically she's reached a point where she has no other choice but to rely on this person's charity. And maybe there's more to it, and we can get into that. But you know, one thing that happens is there's an area that that Sarah likes to go in to have a little bit of alone time, and this area kind of has a reputation as a lover's lane. And basically, Sarah is you know, when Mrs. Pulteney finds out that she's been taking solitary walks by the ocean that happened to, you know, occur partly in this place that has a little bit of an unsavory reputation as somewhere that people go to make out. She's the first time she finds out, she's scandalized by it, says never do that again. And then the second time she kicks her out of her house when it comes out she's been doing it. But, you know, when the that's the kind of thing that, you know, the narrator, when the narrator acknowledges Mrs. Pulteney's horror at that and kind of talks about the backstory for it, the narrator takes great pains to say, okay, well, it may seem to you like this is very strange. Here's actually the backstory for why this is troubling to Mrs. Pulteney. So, you know, there are a lot of things that Austin takes for granted that the narrator goes out of his way in French Lieutenant's Woman to acknowledge. Now, you know, to the question of, you had asked the question, Patrick, and maybe I'm, you know, you can feel free to rephrase this question if I'm not characterizing it right, or maybe it was Chris that said this, but we had made the point that Sense and Sensibility kind of establishes these tight rules of social decorum as something that, in some sense, level the playing field for women in particular, where they might otherwise be disadvantaged. And the question I think you had asked, Chris, was if French Lieutenant's Woman takes the same perspective on those rules, or if it is opposed to them. Is that roughly a good characterization of your thought?
Yeah, I guess, I mean, you got to, you I think you pointing out that that Sense and Sensibility happens within the consciousness and time of Jane Austen and the characters that she's writing about, whereas the French Lieutenant's Woman is told from the perspective of the author looking back, and at times even sort of uses the events to jump off into essayistic he writes pretty critically of the hypocrisy of the time and how a lot of the I think really specifically sexual urges and
sexuality in general.
Yeah, I realize, like, it's just sexuality in general is really repressed in society, and then given a place in France, for instance, where Charles, the main male figure, is sent to just sort of exercise some sexual demons. Mm-hmm. But whereas sexuality is repressed in society, it's given, a space that is sort of never acknowledged. And in that way, actually, it becomes it manifests in extraordinarily unhealthy ways for men and women at this time, and the writer writes about that very explicitly. And it seems almost that the narrative at times is just supporting that argument.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I wonder, especially on a second reading, I wonder if it, I mean, until about halfway through the book, for the first half of the book, I think both times that I read it, my thought basically was, okay, well, these people are terribly sexually repressed. They're as sexually repressed. It seems like they're about as sexually repressed as any society on Earth could be, right? I don't really know enough comparative anthropology to know if that's true, but they're immensely, immensely sexually repressed. Boy, that sucks. Shame for them, right? Glad I'm not them. But there's a sort of an interesting kind of essayistic turn. Maybe not a turn, but about halfway through the novel, there's a digression that Fowles goes into that I think complicates that a bit, right? There's a section where he talks about it. It's chapter 35, and he talks a little bit about the sort of immense, not precisely the hypocrisy involved, right, but the ways in which the statistic, for instance, that in that period of time, one in 60 houses in London was a brothel, right? And talks about the huge volume of pornography that was being produced, and talks about the kind of has a passing reference to a society in which scientists are told that. In which scientists maintain that women cannot have orgasms and every prostitute is trained to fake one, right?
That's my choice of favorite line of the book.
That's mine too, yeah, yeah. Where it was universally maintained that women do not have orgasms and yet every prostitute was taught to simulate them. Starting with that kind of that hypocrisy and repression, he then goes on to make the point that, and I think kind of narratively then bears this out in the relationship of Sarah with the other main character, Charles, goes on to make the point that the level of repression that they experience has the side effect of making any individual instance of, for a lot of people, has the effect of making any individual instance of sexual experience intensely, intensely special and distinct, and that there's a level of power that the experience of sex might have had for those people that it doesn't have for us with the benefit of our liberation, right? And I thought that was an interesting point because it's not, I don't think that Fowles is actually entirely critical of that repression, right? He's very open about recognizing the trade-offs that come in moving from a repressive to a liberated mode, and that in some sense there's an intensity of experience that the Victorians might have had around even a kiss that, for the most part, you know, once we're not virgin teenagers, that we just don't have in our daily lives. And I did think that point was interesting, and I'm not sure how to tie it to the larger question of, I guess if the larger question is like, how is this book looking at repression versus how Sense and Sensibility looks at repression, that's one area where it's actually more charitable toward Victorian repression than you would think from much of the rest of the novel.
That's interesting because it seems like you're saying like there's a degree of moral relativism, like just that being like cultures are different and we can't, you know, like we can't criticize a person born into Nazi Germany, you know, for becoming a Nazi because of cultural relativism, and like different values and come with trade-offs, and there isn't just progress, but actually compromise in things. And I really felt like the book was, I think I see what you're talking about, but I felt like it was very so explicitly critical of
sure.
Maybe a second read through would give me more of that nuance, because it felt very, very opinionated against this world.
Well, and it might be that I'm reading too much into that passage. I do think that there's a way in which, I don't know, like it's hard not to think that ultimately the book is coming down on the side of, so I mentioned earlier that there were two ways that this stood against Sense and Sensibility, right? And one of those was the particular narrow question of repression, and then the other thing that I had thought about was, more broadly speaking, this book is three-dimensional in time, right? It's the events of everything that happens in 1867 is analyzed relative to how it would shake out into years and years and years into the future. And there are all these ways in which he kind of takes these, there are a bunch of ways in which Fowles as a narrator will kind of zoom in on a person or an object or a moment and look at the repercussions that would have into the future, sometimes in very minor ways. At one point Sarah Woodruff buys a teapot, and Fowles kind of mentions in passing that he actually now has that same teapot, and you know that to him it's a treasured antique, but she bought it for 3 pence at a secondhand shop, right? Or you know, another character, there's a passing reference to there's a character who is a servant from the country, a female servant from the country, and there's a passing reference to her great great granddaughter being one of the great film actresses of the modern world. And neither of those sound actually all that interesting as details just kind of pulled out of context, but there's something about this is a very well researched book, right? It occupies its moment in a very credible way, in a very full way, to me at least. And so because of the richness with which it lives in that moment, there's an extra level of power in those kind of moments of stepping outside of it and thinking about how things resonate into the future. And that, I think part of the reason that that's surprising to us as readers is that so much Victorian, and you guys might have read more Victorian stuff than I have, you, Patrick, in particular, but so much Victorian writing, it portrays a world with a certain kind of set of values and mores and norms, and sets it up in a way that feels like it has a kind of permanence, right? Like the society of Sense and Sensibility, there's no sense that things used to be a different way or that things might be a different way in the future, right? The particular world that lives in feels very hermetically sealed from other economic worlds, other ways in time, forward or backward. It's this narrow little, all Jane Austen's books that I'm familiar with at least, and a lot of other Victorian literature, kind of take this very narrow slice of time and treat it as eternal, right? And so it's interesting to see a novel that takes the same social questions, the same setting, and tries to like stretch them out into the future as much as possible. Does that make sense?
I understand your overall point. I don't know about this idea. I like the metaphor of, you know, Austen's novels as hermetically sealed, but not necessarily as eternal. I'm specifically thinking of Northanger Abbey, in which there is Like in time, it's hermetically sealed, but there's certainly an awareness of a worldview outside of that the one the author is presenting in that novel.
Sure.
So I'm not quite like the word eternal. Is there something specific you're getting at with that? That I'm not quite understanding.
I don't know that I can get any more specific than. I don't know if there's anything more specific I'm getting at precisely. I guess just the. I mean, this is about French Lieutenant's Woman is about. Let me put it a different way, maybe, and maybe this is a less dramatic way to put it, but maybe by being less dramatic, it'll be more convincing. Like. And again, you have the advantage of being more familiar with Austen than I am, right? But based just on Sense and Sensibility, there's no sense in Sense and Sensibility that, like, maybe the way things are won't be how they are forever, and that awareness should play into the characters' minds in any way, right?
Mm, sure, yeah.
Whereas French Lieutenant's Woman is very explicitly about the collapse of the Victorian or the 19th century social model, right?
You have
these two characters, Charles and Ernestina. Ernestina being Charles's fiance at the beginning of the novel. You have these two characters who are these very kind of classically 19th century figures, and then you have and who in some ways are even like, you know, one thing that we talked about in the discussion of Sense and Sensibility was the ways in which some of the characters seem kind of two-dimensional or flat, right? And whether or not their two-dimensionality and their flatness is whether that's an aesthetic fault on Austen's part or whether that's actually just an accurate reflection of the flatness of a certain type of person in that society, right? And Charles and Ernestina are... in some ways are flat in the same way, but they kind of even consciously recognize it in themselves, you know? And then they encounter this other person that kind of has, as an individual, has the, I'm talking here about Sarah, they encounter this person, Sarah, who has kind of the psychological complexity of a 20th century literary character. Right. And so in some sense, it's like these two people who in both their it's these two people, Charles and Ernestina, who are kind of incarnations of a certain sort of 19th century flatness, encountering this person who is by our contemporary ideas, a more rounded person and within the realm of the novel, a more rounded character. And Charles, in some sense, being yanked out of his 19th century mode of being into a greater complexity, and you know, in the process kind of symbolizing the larger shift that would happen in the culture overall. I guess that's more what I mean when I talk about just to kind of wrap up, like when I mentioned what I said about eternal, there's no sense that anybody in a Jane Austen novel will change with history in the way that the characters in French Lieutenant's Woman do. Sorry, go ahead, Chris.
I was going to say there's a little bit of, I think that there may be a little bit of a functional reason for that, being that the Jane Austen novels are late 1700s, early 1800s, and so pre-Darwin.
Yeah.
Whereas Charles, even if we didn't have Fowls of
and really Bang, they are pre-Victorian too. They're like right on the edge of the beginning of the Victorian era. But go on.
I don't think that their Regency, right? But the Regency to early Victorian, I think most of the kind of social modes and economic modes that we're talking about are very similar between the two eras.
Sure.
Yeah.
And I think I sympathize with what Hans is saying. Maybe timeless is the word that occurs to me more than eternal, and maybe remote when it comes to a sense of pluralism in multiple dimensions. So like you don't have other than occasional references to soldiers who might or might not be on the island of England, and maybe references to some international events But there is a really great remoteness in Austen's novels, I'd say, that can make them feel kind of timeless. And in this case, I think even without the author interposing himself, you have Charles being so interested in natural history, which is this, it just immediately breaks that sense of isolation from time and
right.
of timelessness, because you have from the outset of the novel this idea of things passing, not just like
right.
Not just the Victorian era, but mankind and species and geologic, you know, massive geological change, or geological. So I'd say that is like a real, for me, a very interesting distinction. I can't really think of, like, I'm trying to think of other sort of Victorian writers. I would have to revisit like Vanity Fair and think about that. But certainly between Jane Austen and this novel, I kind of agree.
Yeah. And it might be maybe in Dickens that you might see that a bit more, just because of the scale that Dickens works on. I don't know for sure, though. I'm not as familiar with any kind of 19th century stuff as arguably I should be. So,
I had a question about the endings. We should talk about the multiple endings. What is the deal with the multiple endings? There you go.
You know, I was actually, you beat me a little bit to the transition there, Chris. You did to me what I was just about to do to you, because I had been, like, there are some ways in which...
just like in the locker rooms, growing up.
Yeah.
I do to them what they're about to do to me.
There are some...
It doesn't reflect well on you, I don't think.
Nah, man, I'm first.
All right.
Well, I was just going to say there's some very meta parts of this novel. And I know that maybe the word meta gets overused, but like there are places where this novel is about as meta can be, right? Like about as metafictional as, I mean, like the narrator like steps in and says, well, you know, I'm not really sure why they're doing this, but sometimes that's what characters do and you just have to kind of follow them where they're going to go. As to the question of the two endings, so just to kind of establish, what happens essentially is Charles abandons his fiance, or not abandons, but breaks off his engagement to his fiance, and determines to pursue Sarah, and he, you know, goes through a period of exile while he tries to find her. And eventually is given her address. Another character in the novel kind of spots her out on the street and sends him her address. And he approaches her and they have kind of a tense conversation. And then it turns out that she's been raising his child for the period he was in exile, and they reconcile. And it seems as though they're going to get somewhat of a happy ending and live together in some kind of context, right? And then the scene kind of shifts to a figure outside who winds his watch back 15 minutes, and all of a sudden they're back at a pivotal moment in their confrontation, and it goes a little bit differently, and they get a little bit nastier with each other, and he leaves and goes out into the world feeling for the first time, I don't know how to describe it exactly, truly in charge of his own destiny in a very melancholy way, right? But like he's on the other side of some kind of great river that he can't cross back through, and you know, the future is unknown. So the question of the question of the two endings, they are, you know, on the first time through that I read this book, the two endings just completely flummoxed me, right? And there's a, they are, the two endings are, and I'm not sure, it was easy for me to catch this being a rereader, but there's, I don't know if you guys remember this section. There's a part where Charles, probably about 60, 70 pages before the end, there's a scene where Charles is in a railway car. And he encounters a character who is staring at him in a very kind of piercing, uncomfortable way. And it turns out that character is like John Fowles, kind of, you know, instantiating himself into the world of the novel, right? And let's see. And there's a little disquisition that Fowles goes into that I think forecasts that the strange dual endings and that kind of 15-minute rewind that changes the ending, right? And he does he does the little thing that predicts that. And so he says, he talks a little bit about, he looks at Charles and he says, "What the devil am I going to do with you? My problem is simple. What Charles wants is clear, but what Charles wants is clear, but it's not quite so clear what Sarah wants," right?
Schrodinger's Sarah.
Yeah, exactly. There's an indeterminacy, right? Fiction usually pretends to conform to the reality. The writer puts the conflicting wants in the ring and then describes the fight, but in fact fixes the fight, letting that want he himself favors win, right? So it's so there's what I would read that as Fowles saying basically is that there's something he said a few times, which is that even though he's the author of the novel, Sarah is kind of impenetrable to him, right? He doesn't quite get Sarah. There are times when he says he doesn't totally understand what's going on in her mind, and that's something that distinguishes her from the kind of two-dimensionality and transparency of Charles and Ernestina, right? And so he basically kind of says, you know, 50 pages before the ending, like, "I'm not quite sure what she wants, and I don't want to fix the fight. I don't want to... He kind of shows a sort of unwillingness to kind of trample on her free will, right? And he flips a coin. He says, "Well, you know, what I'm probably going to have to do is kind of look at both versions of whether Charles gets what he wants or not. And I'm going to flip a coin. And I know that, like, whichever one I put last will seem like the true one, even though they're both equally true. So I'm going to flip a coin to see which one is last." He flips a coin, and that's the end of the chapter, right? So, I mean, I think that the setting up the dual endings that way, what he's doing there is he's saying that he's using the meta elements, like the meta elements that have to do with the kind of opacity or impenetrability of the characters. He's using those as a way of highlighting the distinction between the 19th and 20th century modes of kind of both thinking about psychology and of writing, maybe. The difference between these kind of two-dimensional predictable characters with a certain clearly defined set of wants and needs versus this other character who is less rational, who the reasons why she does what she does aren't always definable, who kind of behaves in a more 20th century mode. And what he does when he sets up that dual ending is to basically portray that as a way of respecting that, maybe set that up as a way of respecting that aspect of her. Does that seem like a tolerable reading? It's the best I got.
No, that's well, you go, Patrick.
Oh, I was just going to say, I'm not sure I'm satisfied with that. I mean, I really enjoyed this novel, and I thought the meta aspect was interesting, but I also thought it was the least successful aspect. For the first couple of chapters, I forget how many, the reader, or at least I thought, and I'm pretty sure everybody thought this who read this, the narrator, I thought, was a character within the novel, an historian commenting on what was in the novel a real history. Does that make sense what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Okay. So, but then he does this turn where he's like, no, I'm not a historian character in the novel. I'm the author of this novel, right? So,
yeah.
So it explicitly becomes metafictional. And I thought that I was actually, when that happened, I was actually pretty disappointed. I was like, do we have to go on this thing about fiction again? Oh my God. You know, I'm like, oh, please, do we? Despite that, I really enjoyed this novel. I thought it was great. And, but it was a part of the novel that I really don't feel like it. I don't. So what I love about the novel is the essayistic ramblings on, you know, Victorian culture, you know, the quotes from Karl Marx, the examination of class, the examination of sexuality. I really enjoy those things, and I don't see the need for the whole, like, why make the turn from I'm a historian character within the novel to I'm the author. I don't get it. Mm-hmm. I don't see what it does.
Let me make a case, because I hadn't thought about this.
I don't like that case.
Okay.
No,
fine,
go on.
Fine. So, Hans, you said, and I might be misstating, but that he didn't want to trample on Sarah's free will. And her kind of character seems in opposition to grand narratives shaping who she's supposed to be anyway. So, like, so that's that kind of fits if you're going to sort of like give Sarah a win, it would actually be two endings rather than one, even if in the ending that she gets, she sort of spurns Charles, as we get with the second ending, because either way she is basically nailed down. And I wondered, I don't know that it does this. Does he say that the first ending is like a more traditional ending, like for a Victorian
I don't think he's
novel?
I don't remember him saying something to that effect. No, in the section I was reading a little while ago, he calls it optimistic. But that's,
yeah.
I don't know that he calls it traditional. He might somewhere. I don't remember that, though.
I don't either. I just was thinking, if you were to kind of map those endings out, like, to, like, where they would fit, the second ending is definitely the more modern one. Like, that's, of course, how the book would end, right? Like, if it was written by a relatively well-respected author and it had that sort of bittersweet ending, you know, you'd expect a 20th or 21st century novel to end with her politely telling him to go and them both growing a lot in the process, because we're in this age of, you know, more individualistic agency and getting less meaning from another person. But then it feels like that what would be closer to the traditional ending of the period in which the novel takes place is the first one. And so there is a kind of a way in which that, I don't know, like, it feels like by having both endings, we get to keep Sarah mysterious, and we also get to keep, like, the sort of grand narratives that determine the proper way to end a novel a little bit mysterious as well. Depending, you know, if we're thinking about the times in which it is set, the time in which it is set relative to the time in which it is written. I don't know. I'm partial to meta, so I'm partial to defend it no matter what too.
Well, yeah. It's
I mean,
not
I don't
that
know
I'm...
that I can't make a passionate argument for the meta stuff as being totally inextricable from the working of the novel, right? I can certainly imagine a version of this novel that's 90% the same, but you snip out the meta bits and it would be just fine. It'd be, you know, just as good, really, probably. I didn't find them tiresome or unpleasant necessarily, but I'm not sure that I can construct an argument for them as being something that the novel would collapse without, you know?
Well, I actually think like 90% is an underestimate. You could take 99.9% of this novel if the narrator character is a historian in the novel, you can still do the exact same novel, just without this, you know, really not that interesting comment on fiction. Is like
so here's a question for you.
Yeah.
Here's a question for you. If you, in that version, you would only have one ending. Which ending?
No,
you
could
have.
You could have two endings.
How would you have two endings without the meta stuff?
Oh no, you're right. You're absolutely right. The historian who is. Okay, which ending do I have?
Yeah, which ending would that version of the novel have? And corollary question, what would you lose by not having that other ending, right? What is there in... I mean, I'm assuming probably, like, you probably would not have the bit where they reconcile and stay together, right? I guess I answered that question for you, but probably you'd
That's right. I think the...
You'd have the bittersweet ending, not the happy ending. What would you lose by not having that vision of them in reconciling and embarking together in happiness?
Well, not much, because I don't think it does much.
Okay.
I mean, I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. I was thinking maybe if I framed the question right, I could trick you into, you know, but didn't work. So
I mean, I really feel like this whole two endings thing is like... I mean, I don't think it's thematically out of the blue. I just think that the meta stuff isn't that well interwoven with the social critique stuff. And I don't think it's as interesting as the social critique stuff. So that's just my personal response to it. And
yeah, and I'm not like I'm not offended on behalf of the novel that you don't like the meta stuff. I'm just trying to figure out if there's some, you know, like if maybe it's something that we it's something that we don't think is a support beam, but then we yank it out and the roof collapses, you know? And
right.
We thought,
yeah.
I thought that was just decorative, right? Like I'm just trying to really see if there's some way that that's
right. No,
a support
and
beam
I
and
I
not
would...
a decorative pillar.
I would like to know if it's a support beam. Like, so far, neither of you have convinced me. But if it is a support beam, I'd like to know. And really, I don't even want to be that critical of this novel. As I said, I think it's really great.
And you've also said that it's, you know, the meta stuff is 0.01% of it. So disliking 0.01% of it is
right,
a pretty good pretty good padding average.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely.
It's very funny. It's very, very funny. I enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah, the just to say my favorite line also, there's a switch from one chapter about Sarah being, you know, this is really depressed, you know, unfortunate soul. And then we switch in the next chapter to Dr. Grogan and Charles. And the phrase he uses to refer to them is the Lords of Creation, which just cracked me up. I thought that was a really, really funny, really good line. Like, nicely, ironically done. Like, you know, Sarah's getting scragdogged, and you know, here the lords of creation are, you know, chatting away.
Is Fowler going so heavy, hard to bat for women? Characteristic of his other books too. I think. Did you read the Magus?
I've never read anything else of his.
Okay. He's
What did you just call him, Chris?
He's great. What did I call him?
Yeah, I think you just called him Fowler.
Oh,
Fowler.
Sorry,
it's just funny because Patrick got it wrong at the beginning.
Yeah.
Knowles Fowler. Sure. Yeah.
But no, there is something about that name. Like, I was at the bookstore yesterday and I saw a novel by John Hawkes and I thought, oh, I loved French Lieutenant's Woman. I should pick this up.
Sure.
So wait.
Is that John Hawkes the actor?
No, it's John Hawkes the novelist.
Are they the same person?
No, I don't believe they're the same person.
Oh,
no.
Damn it. But have you guys heard of John Hawkes? Do you know who he is?
I've heard of the director, Howard Hawkes.
Yeah. No, that's Howard Hughes.
I thought Howard Hughes was the airplane guy.
He's a director and an airplane guy. That's his spiel. He's a rich director airplane guy.
Oh, okay. Or was.
Yeah, and he dated Katharine Hepburn for a little bit.
Oh. When I was young, I was really into the Hoxtables.
All right. But,
well, is there anything that we wanted to we wanted to cover in relationship to French Lieutenant's Woman that we didn't get to?
There is one last thing that I wanted to say. And I've kind of been brooding on it this whole podcast. And I felt I thought there would come a time to like just say it and just be like boom. But I feel like in framing this against Sense and Sensibility, it feels a little strange to me. I feel like just because. I 100% agree. In retrospect, after our discussion on Sense and Sensibility, Hans, I absolutely agree that that Austin is not doing as much as she could, or doing much at all, to talk about repression as the repression of proprietarism.
Okay.
Propriety, if you know what I'm saying. You know, she's not really talking about that. There is some, I think there is an economic consciousness that she's getting at. I think that, you know, satirizing upper classes is something she's interested in doing and in that small way trying to address economic inequality. But she's not doing what Knowles is doing, which is, you know, really looking at sexual repression. And so I agree with you, but I also feel like,
Fowles is doing, for that matter.
Fowles, duh. Oh, Jesus. Or what Fowles is doing. But is it is it fair to really... I mean, I don't know.
I don't want it to seem like, I don't want it to, boy, I really don't want it to seem like my model here or my mode was to kind of come in and go, John Fowles destroys Jane Austen, boom.
Right.
Right.
Right,
I guess
you.
Like, there's, reading the Fowles before I read Jane Austen gave me a slant on the era that was difficult enough to shake that it really colored how I read the Austen.
Right.
And so I thought it would be interesting to give you guys that perspective because it had informed my perspective on the Austen. I definitely, and I worry that maybe I came across this way too much in the last podcast. I don't think that it's, I don't want to come across as saying that Jane Austen sucks because she's not socially conscious enough, right? Like,
right.
I think that, I mean, I don't think that it's an aesthetic or moral failure of Jane Austen to not be more like,
Thomas Hardy,
right?
Right. Well, it might be a moral failing, but is it an aesthetic failing?
Well, and I don't even... It's certainly not an aesthetic failing. I mean, I think if anything, like, the insularity of that world makes it easier to construct a compelling plot and a compelling set of characters, right? It's
right.
Like, it's like any other situation where you have... When you give someone a very limited set of artistic tools, sometimes that can be stimulating to make something really effective, right? And the insularity
right.
of what Austen writes about is a form of limitation, and when she uses that limitation in an effective manner, the craft that involves is very impressive to see.
Mm.
Just kind of on an aesthetic level, was I maybe a bit unmoved by Sense and Sensibility relative at least to Pride and Prejudice, which I kind of thought did a lot, did some of the same stuff more effectively? Yeah, maybe so, but
sure.
Like, I don't think it's an aesthetic failing, and for that matter, I don't really even think that it's a, I don't think that it's really a moral, I don't think Jane Austen was a bad person or an inadequate artist because she didn't work harder to kind of go, well, but what do the servants think, right? Like,
right.
I mean, I think if you only ever read Jane Austen, you're getting a very limited view of
sure.
the Victorian era. But
absolutely.
But I mean, you know, if you only ever read John Fowles, you're getting a very limited view of certain things too. So, yeah.
Interesting. And I don't know, that's a that leads me to, you know, wider questions about what, you know, how we respond to literature that is from a totally different worldview and culture. You know,
right.
And it goes into like cultural relativism as you know, Chris mentioned earlier. I think, you know, I guess it depends on how you understand that term, but it's probably more than like we'd probably have to devote an entire episode to, like, you know, should we condemn Homer for being entrenched in a society that, you know, was warlike and, you know, thought
sure.
war was, you know, war was the way that you
lived in the world.
Yeah, right. Lived in the world, exactly. So it's you know, it's an interesting question.
I mean, I think there's a difference between recognizing and condemning in practice. I think
sure.
in principle, it's easy to mistake recognition for condemnation.
Sure.
Particularly because, I mean, the people who are most motivated to seek out, you know, the moral failings of past artists are probably also the ones who have the most emotional stake in recognizing the ways in which they've failed
right.
morally.
Right. Absolutely. That's a very good point. Very good point. So
Patrick,
yeah.
Did reading The French Lieutenant's Woman make you? Is there anything that it made you want to read next time around?
Oh, it's Chris's turn next time. Remember, because we switched.
Is it? Oh.
And remember,
I
already picked Where We Land next time that I'm doing it, so we can talk to we can bring Daryl.
Oh
on.
Yes. I was. Okay. Yeah, Chris. Sorry, Chris. Bad setup. It's your turn, Chris.
Yeah, I was thinking about the Windup Bird Chronicle, by Murakami.
Oh, nice.
But I was actually open to 1Q84 is really big, but there's also Kafka on the Shore. I'd be open to suggestions. The first one that came to mind, the one that I think I liked the most, probably out of all of them was Windupbird Chronicle or Kafka on the Shore. So I don't know if either of you have read them or if you guys have an opinion.
I've never read any Murakami.
And I read Windupbird Chronicle twice, and I've read Kafka on the Shore and 1Q84. I've read almost everything by Murakami.
Well, what do you think, Hans?
Well, I don't know that I want to read Windupbird Chronicle a third time, actually. Well, maybe if I did, maybe it would be illuminating. Here's the thing, like, the first time that I read Windupbird Chronicle, I found it immensely fascinating and moving. And I found it immensely fascinating and moving, and I mean, I don't even want to go into it, but it really hit me in the right place at the right time. And
aww, you're human.
And then on a reread, it really didn't hold up to a reread, right? It didn't feel like there was anything to get out of a second read that I hadn't gotten out of a first, you know?
Hmm.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's a fault of Murakami. I certainly don't think it's, I think if Windupbird Chronicle has that fault, then probably all Murakami has that fault, because I don't think he ever did a better novel. But I think it's hard for me to say why. My gut response is I'm most interested in going back to 1Q84. Maybe partly because it's dramatically very engaging, but it's kind of confusing. It's not confusing. It's not any more confusing in terms of what's happening than any other Murakami, but like Windupbird Chronicle, you know, I can very clearly tell you what that's about. Kafka on the Shore, I can kind of tell you what that's about. 1Q84, I'm not really sure I'm not sure thematically what it's even trying to do, or if it is trying to do anything thematically. And that's kind of why I'm the most interested in going back to it. Even though it's explicit. Fucking mammoth, as you've pointed out.
Yeah, it's big.
But it's a quick
read. It is explicitly. Yeah, I started it and I didn't stick with it for some reason, and I'm looking for a reason to finish it.
I'd be down.
But yeah, and it explicitly is referencing Orwell. So there you go, Patrick.
Oh, that you know, if it references Orwell, I gotta love it, right?
I don't know if that's true, but maybe.
No, I gotta, I mean, it's got to reference Orwell in the right way, but I am totally open to reading Murakami. I've never read, I think I read like a short story by him or something like that I didn't understand. But how big is 1Q84?
It's big.
It's about 1,000 pages, I think.
All right, so yeah, I mean, that's fine. I'll probably need more than 2 weeks to finish it then, because I'm not a, I, you know, it takes me time.
It's not dense, you know, like it's 1,000 pages, but it's about 1,200 pages actually, but any one given page of it is not nearly as dense as most things we read, for what that's worth.
Okay.
Let's see where we're at in you know, the week after next.
Okay.
And cool. 1Q84.
Sounds good.
I actually had a quick, not 1Q84 really related discussion
on
question
Audible
before we go.
It's 46 hours. Yeah.
46 hours.
Okay. Yeah, that'll take me some time, but that's all right. Yeah, I'm totally up for it. Go, Hans.
Just quick unrelated question, just sort of general book question. So my copy of The French Lieutenant's Woman is a very cheap mass market paperback, and the binding is all dried up and falling apart, and it it held up to a first read okay, but the second time through, it reached that point where pages are now falling out.
Oh, no.
And my question is just, what, like, it's done, it's dead, right? I really, really liked this book a lot. I didn't say that in the discussion, but I was immensely fond of it. I found it very smart and moving and fun and yada yada. And I really hate the idea of just tossing it in the trash or the recycle bin, right? What's the most dignified way to dispose of a dead book that was really, really important to you?
Don't dispose it. Get some manuscript glue and just glue the pages and the cover back on.
Oh, okay.
That's what I would do.
Yeah, I guess I could do that. I was going to just toss it into the woods, actually. I figured, you know.
Yeah.
Why the woods?
You can give.
Well, because I have woods in my backyard. It's convenient.
It's biodegradable.
Yeah, it's biodegradable, so it can return to the earth.
All right. Whatever you feel that you want to do. Like, if you want to keep it in your collection, though, you should glue the pages back in. If not, you know, let some squirrel choke on the paper he tries to eat.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that answers my question.
All right. Okay, everyone.
Talk to you guys later.
I hope, dear listeners, that you enjoyed this podcast on the French Lieutenant's Woman. Pretty fantastic novel. Thank you for suggesting it, Hans. You've been hitting them lately. What was French Lieutenant's Woman was really good. Bones of an Inland Sea was really good. The Goldfinch was pretty good. Man.
Well, Chris wasn't too keen on the Goldfinch. I don't know if we...
Oh, yeah. No, I remember that discussion. He was like, chirp, chirp, you know. You were like, chirp, chirp. Oh, God, that mewling little bastard protagonist guy. I get it, though. I get it. All right, listeners, tune in next time. Peace out.